Your voice.
Your station.
Let's walk the talk.
702 Summer.
The author of the book is Adeke Adebayo. The book is called Prophets, Poets, and Philosophers of the Pan-Africanist Pantheon. Interesting title there. And my guest is Kofi Kwaku, who is an Africa analyst. We've had many, many conversations in the past to talk about this book. Kofi, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you very much. Over a long time, and good evening to you and to your listeners.
Pan-Africanism is usually associated with certain political parties, certain individuals. First coming up as a South African, when I think of Pan-Africanism, I think of Robert Mangaliso Sobukwe. I suppose more globally, you think of people such as Kwame Nkrumah, who's really understood to be the father of Pan-Africanism. But it goes a little bit further than that, doesn't it, Kofi? And that's why it's important for us to be talking about this book.
Yes, indeed, it does. And what is important about it is, I mean, it's such a vast subject that attempting to do justice to it in one volume is a challenge indeed. But at least, you know, putting a little, you know, stick inside that story is really something very important. So what this book really has done is to take a thematic approach to telling part of that story of Pan-Africanism, and then how it's underpinned by specific people who play the role into making this sort of movement or this wave of concern or reaction to both slavery and colonialism come to life. So it does have a sort of biographical sketches of those prophets, poets, and then, if you want, you know, the pioneers of this whole thing, and then philosophers, of course. And I think that's what it is. So, but it's not it's really, as in all great work, there's always choices that you have to make. Of course, I have my beef with some of the, you know, the people who are missing out there. For example, Mandela is not there. Sheikh Anta Diop was a key person out in Senegal who wrote Civilization and Barbarism. You also have forgotten people like Patrice Lumumba, Sekou Toure, Thomas Sankara, and even Pele. I think they should have had a sport, you know, a section there or part where you have Pele, but also Muhammad Ali and some of the big thing. But I think it's a good compendium. It's big enough. It's about 655 pages. That's a huge academic book. It shouldn't deter people, because I think that's where we should go. And it takes us, in fact, the first chapter, part one, is about what's called the roots, with O-O-R-O-O-T-S, and then the root, R-O-U-T.
And I suppose it's also a little bit of a hopping back to the movie Roots I've just now lost the name.
Alex Haley.
It's probably a play on that too. But I want to understand from your perspective what looks like a very interesting title: Prophets, Poets, Philosophers of the Pan-African Pantheon. Pantheon is a very European symbol, but here we are talking about Pan-Africanism and luminaries of the ideology of Pan-Africanism. Talk to me about that. What's going on there?
Yes, it's a way. I mean, the way, if you look at it now, languages are a so powerful instrument to convey meanings, but also to appropriate specific power. And I think the word pantheon, although it was it's a Greek word, I mean, you split them both. Pan, which means all, it's a very academic way of saying all, right? Yeah. And then theos, which is gods. So putting the gods up there, all the gods. But it's also basically the idea that you have people who are so important that they're famous one, they're particularly respected, they're high caliber people, famous enough, but also these important people who have shaped something, a specific field, a specific idea, and so forth. And so in doing so, that's what this book is trying to do. But of course, it couldn't put everybody in there.
Sure.
It was a little bit tricky, and I think that's the point I'm trying to make. So there, it's also capturing, I think that there's a binary element that governs this whole book as well about Pan-Africanism. The first one is the ideal. you know, the fact that we're aspiring to something about Africans' unity going forward, so that Africans can be free, can be also sovereign in that unity going forward, right? And it goes all the way back to, in fact, it's not just the 1800, but also to the 1500 before the Portuguese came to Africa.
Yeah.
And it's also a geographic movement itself, because it takes into account the diaspora. It's not just people who live in Africa. The diaspora, which means the descendant of the former slaves that were captured, the between 15 to 20 million. We don't even know the exact number of slaves who were captured and sold to the Americas. And that's what it's trying to do. Capture part of that root, as well as the routes they took to get there, and then stretch it all the way front here into the 20th century to see who are these people? Why do they matter? What is the idea about what does it mean today to be an African, for example? Combining four things: identity, sovereignty, individual naming, and then collectively as well.
The idea of diaspora being, it's one of the little gripes that I have, little old me have, about this, the term diaspora and its meaning in the context of Pan-Africanism, that it doesn't extend to the fact that some Africans, especially in the 20th and the 21st century, have made choices to go to other parts of the world. They're not necessarily in other parts of the world because of the slave trade necessarily, but because of choices that they've made. Maybe they've got some agency, maybe it's necessity, but certain choices have been made. Should they be part of the diaspora, or is the idea of the diaspora only for those people that have their location in other parts of the world other than Africa? Is it only because of the slave trade?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing you put your finger on at the beginning when you start talking, you use the word evolution. So Pan-Africanism has evolved. It's taking many branches. In fact, there's now a great deal of talk about neo-Pan-Africanism, which means people are thinking about it and say, well, you know, the world has changed so fast. It's different from the 14th, 17th, 19th, even 20th century. And things are changing so fast that you need to appropriate languages that will serve the ideal. But the ideal by itself, which means the aspiration that Africans could be united, you need to transform the ideal into an idea.
Yeah.
Something that's practical and doable.
Yeah.
So diaspora is a if you want, it's an instrument to be used to attempt to capture those who are really spread out around the world, not just in Africa. It brings it into account the geographical context of the meaning of unity. How do you unite all these people? You need to identify them. Where are they? Geographically, they're all over the world. And now you have a big growing diaspora of Africans in China, for example, in Japan, in Russia. So do you count all these? So it's a form of accounting the potential contribution to all these groups of people who are African or African descent, to be able to keep them into that unity, so that the work towards a free, if you want, also united Africa with the diaspora.
Kofi, you know, again, maybe we started off too quickly, because I'm almost sensing that we need to perhaps define the idea and perhaps even the ideology of Pan-Africanism even before we continue with this conversation. But I do want to go back to that word pantheon in the title of Adekeye Adebayo's book, Prophets, Poets, and Philosophers of the Pan-African Pantheon. One of the things that I always continue to have a gripe about whenever we talk about the luminaries, the prophets, the poets and philosophers of the ideology of Pan-Africanism, is that we get sometimes to a place where we give them the status of deity almost. That when somebody when somebody quotes Steve Biko or Frantz Fanon, their voice quivers, right? Because it's almost like they're speaking about a canonized deity. Is this title not contributing to that? And I'll tell you why I have a slight problem with this deifying of these great men and women, right? And the one thing that I love about this, it also underscores and talks very, very much about the contribution of African feminism, which you find very, very scarce in many other conversations about Pan-Africanism. So kudos to Adekeye Adebayo as far as that is concerned. But my gripe comes from this perspective, that for as long as we continue to deify those who have been leaders of intellectuality as far as Pan-Africanism is concerned, we deny ourselves in this time the ability to be able to take forward their ideas that will be customized to our conditions. So we canonize them and we deify them. And I think that that has been part of the failure of the Pan-Africanist movement, the failure even of the Black Consciousness Movement, that we cannot at some point free ourselves of the idea that as powerful as these individuals might have been in giving us light to move forward in our incarceration by colonialism and slavery, we disallow ourselves, contemporary Africans, of the opportunity, no, the obligation of conceiving of ideas that are relevant to our times, because we are able to quote Fanon or Du Bois or Garvey. I mean, I love those people, but they don't live in 2021. And my responsibility, after having read what they've got to say about what they had to say about their time, is to then interpret their teachings for my time and not seek to become some little god. So I'm a little worried about the idea of the pantheon, because, of course, in Greek mythology, that is where the gods lived. Is this not a perpetuation of that idea?
I agree with you in large part. In fact, I've been one of the people on the side also throwing stone at this kind of pantheon. Before I come back to your joining you again, I think it's good to remind us of this book, really what it does. It attempts to bring forth, you know, it's a reminder. That's what it is. And putting these people in a pantheon, godifying them and putting them on a pedestal, it makes them some kind of exclusive elite,
yes,
of Black people or Africans who really are considered now, as it's evolved, one of the things that we know is that they've now it's evolved in a place where they now become almost commercialized, petit bourgeoisie, paid off and bought Africans who almost, you know, if you want, are acting by quoting Fanon, Du Bois, and all the other people who sound very important and academic. They're putting themselves somewhere exclusively, yeah, away from everything else. But we know this is exactly the debate that's taking place today. How relevant is this history in going forward? And in fact, the debate, there's a great group of neo-Pan-Africanists, a couple of them that I can cite. One of them, as you called, Kemi Seba from Benin, a young, very tough activist in West Africa. And he's defining new themes for neo-Pan-Africanism. And I think one of the biggest themes that he has now is the abolition of the CFA franc in Francophone Africa, or quote-unquote Francophone Africa, Western and Central Africa, creating the ability to get rid of the CFA, this monetary choking, yep, slavery that's sucking up the blood and the economy of these places. So they're trying to define. The second person is Bobby Wine. Many of you probably heard about Bobby Wine, artist, small businessman, Uganda, yep, but also very, he's now in parliament in Uganda. He's giving a run for the money to Yoweri Museveni, the president who wants to run for life. In fact, he's getting all kinds of trouble. One thing he said, very, very important, and he's galvanizing the crowd there, the kids. So define that new Pan-Africanism, not just in Uganda, but right across the African continent. He said, and that's where I join you and come back to what you were saying about isolating these people, is that he said that most people, most Pan-Africanists, we've been enslaved by the past. And so we can't get away from that past. And if you look at the book does a part of that to really frame us into that root of history so much so that it's hard to come out of them. And the question was, somebody was asking this question, well, that does knowing about the past of Pan-Africanism help pay the bills? Right? That's a powerful question in the sense that, but I always respond with a tiff of cough to say, does watching Manchester United against Liverpool on DSTV help pay the bill as well?
Precisely.
So the key for us is to figure out what really matters in Pan-Africanism as it is evolving. There's a younger generation looking at it. This book is a reminder to pay attention to the past because we can learn from that past. We can take ideas and ideal that we can grow going forward. And I think one of the probably the follow-up of this book should be to look at the future. And we've seen it. We're so trapped in the past. We continuously extol the virtues of great African civilization, Egypt, Mats, or the Nubians, and so forth. But it hasn't stretched to free us from the pain and the yoke of modern colonialism that we're going through. So how do we do it? And young people are doing that. But I think this book is keeping a foot right grounded so that we don't just run around, figure out that we don't have a specific, you know, place to really draw some lesson from. And I think that's what this book is about. And I agree with you, putting it as a pantheon, it's exclusive. But for goodness sake, we need to fight and find a space so that present-day neo-Pan-Africanism does also resonate with both the ideals and the idea of Pan-Africanism.
0118830702. My guest is Kofi. How do I pronounce your name, Kofi?
Kwaku.
Kofi Kwaku. And we're talking about a book written by Adekeye Adebayo, prophets, poets, and philosophers of the Pan-African pantheon. And frankly, what we're doing is we are looking at the whole idea of Pan-Africanism, Pan-Africanists, the ideal of Pan-Africanism, whether it has been formulated into a practical enough idea, yeah, of Pan-Africanism. But I'm asking you this question as you listen to this conversation. Who are the real Pan-Africanists now? What is their message? And what is the character of their message? Is it one that harps on to the past, or is it one that gives us a vision of a new future? Yeah? I know people can quote the hell out of Frantz Fanon. They can quote. You remember the days of university, a coffee when you'd mesmerize the girls by being able to, you know, quote a little bit of, eh? You know, you remember all of that, and you know, you talk a little bit about Ali Mazrui, you talk a little bit about this, and yes. and the girls would fall in love with themselves,
the wretches of the earth.
Yeah, and we did all of that kind of stuff, and many of us got stuck there, and we've even spawned a generation of people who think that being a Pan-Africanist is to simply be able to quote Robert Sobukwe. Mine is, I believe, that all of those luminaries were putting forward or giving us a challenge to be the ones who articulate the next generation's vision and responsibility. And it cannot be just about being able to quote these guys. I think that it's important to know what they've said. I think it's important to know the difference between Dubois and Garvey and what later happened, where there was a focus on earlier, where there was an earlier focus on wanting to get people back to Africa who had been stolen by slavery to the Americas. Remember, there was that phase when everybody was talking about going back to Africa, right?
Yes.
And then there was another phase where there was a conversation about a focus on Africa as it is, not just going back to Africa, but I'm suggesting that Pan-Africanism in our contemporary times hasn't created a new conversation. What has happened is that we've had people that copy and paste the rhetoric of the original Pan-Africanists of their time, But because there is this dearth, this hunger of African intellectualism, we just hold on to that. And we're not giving vision. We're not saying this is the direction we need to follow on the basis of an educated, a passionate Pan-Africanism.
Yes, and I agree with you. This is what the book does well. You know, the book calls upon us to really own our own space and share into this Pan-Africanism. You know, to be able to own it in the way that we can tell our own stories, we can build it in, we can co-create that future for Pan-Africanism. So it doesn't belong anymore to dead people. The ideas still live. The ideas are, if you want, the springboard that should help most of us define the character of that Pan-Africanism. And in 50 years, it's going to be a completely different because the environment, the world would have changed. However, some ideas are very resilient. They're tough. They stay there for a long time. And some of them, many of them are really good. And we need to adapt them and then refine them as we go forward to be able to claim that unity. But most important, that freedom. It's not enough to be united if you're poor in unity. That's one thing. If you're united and you can't feed yourself, you can't eat, you can't really, if you want, do what you need to do to survive, at least meet the basic needs of the Maslow hierarchy of needs, you are nowhere to be free. You are nowhere to be sovereign. And I think this is what the interpolation of the Garveys were telling us. You know, we must be our own. We must find, it doesn't mean that Africa should cut itself from everybody else, but use what is necessary to make sure that this continent not only survives, but thrives with partnership with China, with Europe, with a domination that we've seen over the centuries that completely, if you want, choke the opportunity for Africans to be whatever they want to be. Even with the African Union, the African Union Vision 2063, most people have very little idea what that is all about. But it really, it's also springs out of the Pan-Africanist movement. You know, it's an offshoot. It's a daughter. It's some kind of creation from it. And we have here next to us, close here in Midran, the Pan-African Parliament. You know, which is a very important institution that very few people know about. What do they do? You know, what does it take to become a Pan-Africanist and so forth? And these are the kind of thing. So we need to own a piece of this Pan-Africanism, not just talking about the past.
Let's talk about that, Coffee.
Yeah.
What is Pan-Africanism?
Okay, well, I've designed it already. I've given the old definition of it. It's literally the coming together, all the ideas and ideal that are there to support any African descendant or any Africans for unity, be it somebody who was born in the African continent or the descendant of Africans around the world. That unity is capital. And at the heart of this unity is a government that, if we're united enough, we could be a great people again, or people who have assumed their liberties and sovereignties in economic side, politically, culturally, religiously, and spiritually. That's as simple as it is. It is both an ideal and then an idea.
Somebody says to me that what Pan-Africanism has been reduced to is nothing more than the cursing of the West, Europe, America. And in that space, there is also the fear or the shame of talking about the Arab slave trade. But in that same process is the fear to economize and not just politicize Pan-Africanism, to bring science, the empirical sciences into Pan-Africanism, to bring in philosophy into Pan-Africanism, and not only relegate it and leave it at at one-liners.
To the philosophers and activists, I agree with you. As we said, remember, we agreed that there's been an evolution. So in the sequencing of time and the evolution of Pan-Africanism, or what I would now call neo-Pan-Africanism, is to define that future. And hanging on to this, the definition or the redefinition, the refinement of that definition must be literally issue-based. You know, what are the big issues that we're facing, the challenges that Africa is facing now, on which we can start growing that Pan-Africanism or making it stronger? And many of the key issues that our ancestors or the pioneers of Pan-Africanism faced haven't much changed. They've shape-shifted. And as they've shape-shifted, they've also shape-shifted because of the shape-shifting of the oppressors or the colonial groups. They're also smart enough. Look at, for example, the environment where we are today, where most of our representatives cannot, I think it's Professor, I forget his name, Patrick Bond said, you know, the walk right and the talk left, or the walk left and the talk right. So which means they have very shifty ways of dealing with African problems. On one hand, you see them nicely dressed with business suit and everything else, and they promise a whole bunch of things to people. But in fact, they're the paid agent of a system that is not helping Africans become united enough. If you take the problem of borders, for example, in the continent, and they've managed to make it so easily emotional enough that people say, no, close the borders. Don't open this thing. We can't, and you can't unite if you don't have openness. And this is one very important point. So movement of Africans, and this is where the African Free Trade Continental Free Trade Agreement will be an essential thing when it's launched next January the 1st, although it was a little bit late because of the COVID crisis. But this could be a very good vehicle. We're not saying people should go wherever they want to go. There will be some rules. However, to make that unity possible, there need to be both movement of ideas, great ideas, of course, what we're talking about, movement of people, and then, of course, movement of goods and productive, you know, innovative and creative things that could help to change, but also an infrastructure that could allow that to happen. I mean, I've been hearing something for the past, 5 years or so, where, you know, it's still not quite concrete, that China is attempting to create infrastructure that will connect all African capital, all 54 African capitals by 2050.
Why is China doing that?
That's the point I'm making.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of the reasons neo-Pan-Africanists say, even if we partner with them, what is our stake? Where do we stand? What do we own in this stake or the future of this continent? Because we know if there is no connection, there is no transaction.
Yeah. Look, those conversations are happening even within these borders, albeit sometimes in very unsophisticated ways and so forth, that get very, very sad in the way that we have the conversations about the unity of Africa, the openness that you're discussing. Sometimes we have those conversations in very unsophisticated ways. And I think that is an indictment on those of us who call ourselves Pan-Africanists, that we haven't moved the conversation of Pan-Africanism along enough to cosmopolitize it, if I can say that, to make
most important to add to what you're saying to what you're saying is, we need a new form of education that strengthens the idea of being African. You know, what it is geographically, identity-wise, a sense of place, the sense of belonging, you know, all these important things. But most important, a very simple information base, like the conversation we're having. I mean, at WITS, when I used to study at WITS at this master's degree level, one of my assignments was when I open up the class, I'll give an empty map of the Africa to students. And I'd done it for 10, 13 years. Not one person managed to complete the map to tell me where all these sort of fragmented countries are, get a sense of place. Forget about telling about the capitals. I had students who had put Moscow in Mali. I had three students, I won't say the gender, who cried in class and said, Kofi, I'm being abused because I just can't find, I know you're forcing me to find my memory to figure out. They couldn't even find where South Africa was on this map. So these are basic elements of education that will give the opportunity to people to really strengthen their own knowledge about their own environment, who they are. And I think this is what this book attempts to do, to take people in that space in history first, and then help them to project on themselves and say, okay, here's the history. Where do I belong? Who am I? What does that mean to be an African today? What do I know about this continent that's been fragmented, that's so fragmented that borders are not allowing us to even move within those borders? We're going to need very soon with the COVID complication, you know, health passports. Mm. And that's going to limit the movement. We're already seeing it in South Africa. So these are some of the things that are very important. So what the idea is, so what's next going forward? What does it mean to be an African? And what does it take to be a Pan-Africanist or a new Pan-Africanist today?
Who are the neo-Pan-Africanists today?
I've already given you two names. Kemi Seba from Benin, a very staunch activist. He's been kicked out of France. He's been kicked out of Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, Guinea, everywhere, because he just tells the way it is. There are many of them. But also the young artist, also MP in Uganda, Bobby Wine, musician. That's just two. There are also other people, you know, who are singing. They're using different platforms. It's not just at political level, at economic level, but also, and one thing that we haven't paid attention to is the religion. You know, there's, for example, Pastor Mwonga, that I listen to, who tend to have, I forget his last name, but I think it's Joseph Mwonga. That this man, I'll call him a neo-Pan-Africanist, because he is defining issues, he's shaping them, he's creating them, he's designing them for people to pay attention. He's also educating people. He's also attacking this petite bourgeoisie that pretend to represent Africans, but who are doing the deeds of the puppet masters.
See, and I think that that is our biggest challenge at the moment, that we have people that speak a lot of Pan-Africanism, that speak it, that wear it, that recite it, that quote all of these luminaries and these prophets and philosophers. Very good at it. but they betray the very ideals of what they say that they represent. They betray them so blatantly sometimes that you find yourself shaking.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons the next battle is to expose them, to expose their duplicities, to expose their greed, to expose their corruption, to expose, if you want, the gaslighting of our people, you know, pretending that they're doing something really great for them, but pocketing and stealing the resources, extending the terms of limits, a politician terms of limit to third or fourth, to even president to life, you know, life presidencies and so forth, while not even delivering anything to their own people. I mean, by this stage, we shouldn't be struggling to have Africans who are going to school under trees or go to pit toilet, for example. Yeah. They have that. We shouldn't, at this point, we shouldn't be there. And this is really, it's heartful. But I agree with you, we can't spend the time talking about this pain all the time. We're all traumatized. I mean, day in and day out, we have to suffer this sort of, you know, either if it's not corruption, it's gender-based violence, it's crime. All of these are stemming from the inability and the failure of these petit bourgeois masquerading as leaders who want to take Africa where they're not supposed to go.
We had invited Pastor or Bishop Joshua Maponga a couple of months ago, and unfortunately he wasn't available, and
you couldn't make it. Yeah,
and so we'll probably get him on as soon as
please,
he is available.
Please bring him as soon
indeed,
as possible. He's defining.
Absolutely. So yes, so
he's really defining. Although my point is, he's defining using religion to carve that path for Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he's also very careful about using a white Jesus to really do that.
Yeah.
So he expels all these sort of very toxic element of religion out.
It's Dr. Tarong in Spreadview. Tarong, hi.
Hi, Aubrey.
Yeah, how you doing, Tarong?
I can't complain, condemn, or criticize.
Thank you. Go ahead, Tarong.
Yeah, Mr. Kofi, thanks for producing the book. But I just needed to bring a little bit of nuance around the concept of the Pan-Africanism. I think the concept started, I think, a long time in Trinidad, long before the Atlantic trade slaves in Trinidad. But I don't want to go there because of time. But I just need to also add the other activists who are active right now, who are preaching the gospel of Pan-Africanism, who are pretty much determined. I can mention Dr. Arikana Chihombori from Zimbabwe. She's a former ambassador of the African Union in New York. And then they are busy building a city in Ghana, a city of return.
Yes.
It's called Wakanda City.
Yes.
And then
true.
There's other parts of this.
Yes.
And then the other activist who is very, very, very active is Plo. Professor Plo Lumumba, P-L-O Lumumba.
Yes.
Yes. And then, but also, just lastly, I need to say to Kofi, I mean, if that book does not mention Dr. John Hendrik Clark, then clearly you still need to dig deeper and work. Yeah, because I mean, there's a group of intellectuals and a club of WDB of Du Bois and many others. I mean, Aubrey has already mentioned.
He's in there. He's in there. There's a little.
He's
paragraph
there. Okay, if he's there, then at least because I think he's a there. Very very outstanding scholar historian. Mm-hmm. Who covers the history from 1675 before Christ. You know, for the second colonization of second imperialism of Africa, before even Christianity. Yeah, and then he takes it further down. Yeah.
Yeah. So Tarong, you've come nicotimously into this conversation.
Aubrey, I don't want to expose you, my friend. You know, we come from far together. You dismiss me on this show because of, you know, we all have our biases, but no problem. You know,
I listen to you. Anyway, I've got to say this to you. It might be an error I made. The author of the book is not Kofi, right? It's Adekeye Adebayo.
No, you didn't say it was Kofi. You were very clear. He's the editor, but he's also a contributor to the book. So you have the 38 chapters in there.
One
of them is the introductory chapter, and the rest by very powerful scholars. And so it's a fat book. And quite rich. I think it touches on all these. But as I said, and all of us agree, it's not an easy task. When you edit something,
I'm still there.
You're still here, Tarong. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. No. The book can be fed, but still lack chronological order.
Indeed.
You know, I mean, that is very, very important because chronologically, you can have a lot of content within the book. It can look nice with a nice cover and a glossy publication.
Indeed.
But the content is what is very, very important.
Absolutely.
Whether it is relevant, whether the dates are okay, philosophical or historical relevant. Yeah.
Tarong.
Yes.
Tarong, I hear what you're saying. The book takes into account what you're saying, but it's made the premise of the thematic part of it, which means you have things like, politicians, pioneers, activists, social scientists, economists, philosophers, literary, musical activists. Miriam Makeba is also there. Fela Anipo Kuti is there.
Granted.
And so it's a really, we couldn't talk about all of them. So it's a very
interesting
book to have.
And just also part of Brinet, without putting words into your words, sir. You know, also the concept of the, the diaspora.
Yes.
I think we need to revisit it one day on a different show.
Yeah.
Because the way to diaspora, why does it only refer only to the blacks? Why? What about the Chinese who are scattered all over the world?
Sure.
The Indians are scattered all over the world, but no one is saying they are in the diaspora. Why only us are in the diaspora?
Well,
Africans are Africans.
I'm gonna let you go. Thank you very much for your call. Much appreciated. A very passionate Pan-Africanist and contributor to the show is Tarong. Coffee, we've run out of time, my brother, and I'd love to have more such conversations about ideologies, ideas, their practicability, but not only that, more conversations about raising of consciousness, particularly amongst us on this continent. I really appreciate your time, sir.
Indeed. Thank you very much, and will do. And I look forward to having people by. They can get it with Jacana.
Yeah.
I need a disclaimer. I was part of the conference 3 years ago that made this book possible. So, and I also wanted to thank Professor Adekeye for having done a fabulous job. This is going to be a classic going forward, at least in the roots of Pan-Africanism.
Kofi Kwaku, thank you so much for joining us.